You may have heard a couple of weeks ago when we were joined on the show by Professor Ben Newell of UNSW to discuss the tyranny of psychological distance when it comes to the subject of climate change. Although putting the topic in the back of your mind can be a dangerous barrier for mitigation efforts, what can be said for our politicians? During COVID, our everyday lives and practices have been met with the need for sacrifice for the greater good of everyone. But what about the greater good of the planet? Why is it that similar efforts, or just the idea of these efforts, face such resistance when it's all for the benefit of the environment, and as a result, the benefit of every human being on planet Earth, their children and their children's children? This is, of course, assuming you subscribe to the idea of climate change, though listeners of the very informative and equally enjoyable Democracy Sausage podcast would have heard this touch on in a recent episode. Not the science of climate change, but rather how politics address it. We're lucky enough this morning to be joined by Dr. Maria Teflaga, Director of the Australian Politics Studies Centre in the ANU School of Politics and International Relations, who made some very interesting points on said episode, so I thought it might be nice to pick her brains a little bit further. Maria, how's it going? Thanks for joining the show.
Oh, very well. Thank you for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. First up, there was a mention kind of throughout the episode that the idea of conservative government is to conserve, i.e. maintain the status quo. Is this entirely true? Do you think so in Australia? Or is it rather a little bit of a wool pull over the eyes to just appeal to their demographic and their demographics, prerogatives, agendas, best interests?
Oh, well, that is a very big question, and so I'm going to be an academic. I'm going to take it back a step, just one, and then answer your question. And I guess the first thing I would say about conservatism in general, you're right, it is generally about preservation. But what is kind of often sort of forgotten in our discussions of conservatism is that it's really more that it's opposed to change for change's sake. So conservatives are generally not going to be interested in progressive causes for that precise reason. What they're interested in preserving is the sort of things that have clearly stood the test of time and served society well. But it doesn't mean that they're against change. So change should ultimately be incremental, because change that is incremental is effectively safer. And so when we sort of think about something like climate change, that's why we sort of see a really big difference between perhaps what is happening in the United Kingdom versus what we sort of see in our own country. And so in the United Kingdom, climate change is just nowhere near as controversial an issue as it is in Australia. Conservatives over there sort of understand that they are kind of custodians and stakeholders. You'll sort of see this actually in certain strains of, you know, Christian theology as well, where, you know, it's important for us to be good custodians and to pass on, you know, the earth in relatively good condition to our progeny, which is really the whole point of existence, if you have this sort of world view. I think what has sort of happened in Australia is that, of course, conservatism is not really an ideology in the same way, say, liberalism is, or, you know, communism as another sort of example, or socialism, in the sense that it's actually a set of principles, basically, which all kind of go back to, you know, resisting change for change's sake, preserving the institutions that serve society well, which have traditionally been things like the family, monarchy, and security, right? So maintaining order, that's very important to conservatives. And what we kind of see in Australia is that our Conservative Party is actually a bit of a melange of lots of different interests. And in this country, it's hard not to kind of note that the way, the way Australia was developed, the types of resources we have here to develop have shifted the structure of interests in our country. And so, of course, that has meant the way that climate change is addressed is very different here, where fossil fuels are an important part of the economy and where they are an important part of an interest group that has a lot of sway and a lot of clout, compared to somewhere like the United Kingdom, where, you know, those kinds of heavy industry disappeared many decades ago. And so it's not necessarily that. So that's essentially what is sort of driving it. It's a set of ideas about the world meeting reality of, you know, basically where the money comes from or where it's perceived to come from or where they would prefer it continued to come from.
During the episode, I believe it was Anna Greta made the point that Australia can be resistant kind of to using the term climate change. That might be, to your point, the fact that if you look at the way that our economy is based and kind of what it leans on a lot of the time, the idea of climate change seems to kind of stand very much in the face of that, and it might be a bit of a scary, or at least, I don't know, something that you don't want to address, assuming, being the fact that our economy relies so heavily on it. Do you think that this might kind of impede meaningful efforts then to address the issue? And might it even be fair to suggest that it might be an example of kind of our coalition pandering to US rhetoric and pandering to American policy, similar to that of how Trump essentially avoids the term?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. So I think rather than pandering to US interests, I think what has actually kind of gone on is an adoption of tools and techniques from US style debates, because many of the same kind of interests and philosophical dispositions interact in the United States in similar ways that they do here. And so I don't think that the Australian government or Australian policymakers over decades have pursued these climate policies, which I think, you know, used to perhaps be called denialism and now perhaps is perhaps better described as climate minimization. So you'll notice the government's rhetoric around climate change is that, yes, of course, climate change is happening, but the emphasis isn't on stopping 2 degrees of warming or no more than 2 degrees of warming. It's all around adaption. So yes, climate change is happening, but there's really nothing we can do about it. It's really not that big a problem. We'll focus on adaption. And so that's quite a clever kind of sleight of hand in terms of shifting the debate onto territory that is a little bit easier to sort of manage, but ultimately kind of allows for the same sort of thing, which is to effectively kick the can down the road.
Right. Are there examples of maybe relatively conservative governments internationally making meaningful steps in causes, specifically, I guess, climate or otherwise, through policies that might be considered as progressive or left, or like you said previously, just change for change's sake in an Australian context? I know, for instance, Macron in France, who's relatively centrist, and I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on the topic, but I know he's suing some level of kind of Brazilian kind of deforestation and that kind of stuff. Are there other examples of that internationally?
Yeah, there's heaps of right-wing governments that sort of see that there's money to be made in switching over to
new forms. It's always about the money.
Well, I mean, it's you know what? Let's that was a bit mean. So let's think about it like this. It's actually ultimately about incentives, mm-hmm. right? Everything we do is driven by incentive. Even the Soviets understood this when they set work plans, 5-year plans, and then they set incentives about fulfilling those. So we kind of know that humans respond to incentives and that, you know, prosperity, the good life, security can all be achieved by transitioning to green technologies. And that is why right-wing governments in Europe and in the United Kingdom have been more enthusiastic than they have in Australia. And, I mean, what is kind of important to note is that there are segments of the current government that would kind of like to get in on this game as well. But they are sort of in a pitched battle with those that I think are probably best described as perhaps reactionaries who, you know, want to go back in time, radically go back. And that has basically paralyzed the coalition for more than a decade in being able to make a rational headway. I mean, one of the reasons why we're obsessed with the price of power is because we have a policy vacuum. And so essentially the market is not regulated in an efficient way, effectively. The price signals aren't there to generate the kind of investment we need. And so prices have been going up and the government has simply been unable to resolve this issue. And the latest LNG gas plant is another iteration of effectively trying to square this circle.
It's a very interesting point. I know you have a very busy morning ahead of you, Maria, so I won't hold you up too much longer. Thanks for joining the show this morning, and I will direct listeners to Democracy Sausage Podcast, because like I said, you did make some interesting points on the matter on that most recent episode.
Yes, we'd love to have as many barbecue-based listeners as possible. So thanks very much, Derek.
No, I appreciate your time. Have a good week.
You too. Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Maria Taflaga, Director of the Australian Politics Studies Centre in the ANU School of Politics and International Relations. Like I said, go on to, I guess, podcast app, wherever you find your podcast, similar to that of US of Ed, and look up Democracy Sausage Podcast, or you can reach it via policyforum.net as well.